Today is August 26, 1974, a Monday. The following interview is with Kenneth W. Clawson, C-L-A-W-S-O-N. Mr. Clawson is Director of the Office of Communications. The interview will take place in Mr. Clawson's office in the EOB, room 160. Terry Good will conduct the interview. If there's a telephone call or an interruption or something, I can just flip this thing off so it's no problem. Well, just for a little background, according to what I was able to read before I came up here, you came on board roughly February 7th of 72, is that correct?
That's right.
And then on February 17th, you were appointed Deputy Director of the Office of Communications. Again, that's from one of the press releases that I
think that's correct, yes.
And then, on January 30th of 74, became Director of the Office of Communications. I'm just laying the groundwork for the official titles. Well, with that as a background, could you, first of all, just briefly touch upon how it was that you came to join the White House? Nothing that I was able to read said anything about who it was that called you up or why you came on board. Is that something you could just briefly talk about now, or is it something you prefer to...
Sure. The initial contact was made by Charles Colson, I believe in January of 72. And I rejected the suggestion. Subsequently, Colson made another contact, and then Malik, Fred Malik, and then ultimately Bob Haldeman asked me if I would take over the management of the Office of Communications. He pointed out to me that Herbert Klein, the director of the Office of Communications at that time, was to be on the road continuously during 1972, that he was to be a prime surrogate campaigner for the president, and that I, even though I was to be called Deputy Director of Communications, actually I would have all management responsibilities of running this operation, and Klein would have none. And with that background, I agreed to come.
So for the duration of 1972, officially, you were the manager of the office. What did that involve?
Well, it involved, you're talking about the campaign. That's primarily what
right.
we
just,
did.
Let's just say for 72, because
yeah.
I gather that was more or less the way the job was laid out to you at that point, right?
That's right. And with also the promise that when Klein would be leaving right after the 72 election, then I would succeed him as director. During the 72 campaign, I was had responsibilities for coordinating the press activities at the Committee for Re-election of the President. At the time, the primary press officer over there was DeVan Shumway. Subsequently, we learned that he was not very competent, and we used the old bureaucratic thing. We layered him. By taking Albert Abrams out of the Cost of Living Council and putting him over at the Committee for Re-election of the President as the Communications Director. We did that later in the spring, May probably, of 72. And from that point until the campaign was over with, I was Abrams' reporting person over here at the White House. In addition to that, we prepared in my operation much of the written material that was used by all presidential surrogates. Talking papers, fact sheets, in effect the White House line that was distributed to top White House officials, distributed to cabinet officers, and to all those who were designated as presidential surrogates.
Did you do any traveling during this time, Ken, or did
no.
pretty much operate out of this office?
No, it was designed that I was to stay right here and manage the operation. I was a member of, and I guess you'd say vice chairman of what we call the attack group. Charles Colson was chairman of it. I was the vice chairman. Patrick Buchanan, Al Abrams, Desmond Barker, Wallace Johnson, and Ed Failer were the other primary members of the attack group. Now, the attack group, of course, was a political response mechanism. We did two things, basically, and that was that when our opponent in the election attacked us on a certain point, it was the responsibility of this group to very rapidly respond to that attack. The second thing that the group did was to initiate attacks on our opponent based on his stance on various issues. So I think the attack group, because it was called the attack group, that in some people's mind it wasn't, it took on a more ominous character than it actually was. It was a PR group is what it really boiled down to. Now, in addition to that, I was the president's representative on the surrogate scheduling group, which was headed initially by Bart Porter at the committee to reelect the president. But they did such a bad job in that area that the president asked Dwight Chapin and I to, in effect, take over the surrogate scheduling group. It was a natural thing in my case because as the preparer of the material that the surrogates were to say, it was a natural thing for me then to be also concerned with where they said it. In effect, that was my connection with the surrogate scheduling operation.
Did you also suggest which surrogate should speak?
Oh, yes. No question about it. Most of the time then it was a natural thing. If he attacked us on a defense policy, it was then pretty clear that Melvin Laird, who at that time was Secretary of Defense, should respond. Most of the time it was very easy to know who was going to respond and who was going to attack. And sometimes in areas where it was less clear, then you had to make a subjective judgment on who ought to do it.
Based on what you told me, it sounds like this is at least a 10 or 12 hour day operation during the campaign period, is that correct?
Oh, it was more than that. It was more like 14 to 16 hours a day through the entire campaign.
So you were devoting your entire day, for all intents and purposes, to the campaign, to the surrogate scheduling, speaking, and getting these PR brochures together?
Well, there was another aspect of this. I was also a member of the news planning group. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Let me just talk in time terms now. That's an easy way to look at it. The surrogate scheduling group met every morning at about 8:30 a.m. in room 345 of the old executive office building. It's a conference room that housed Mark Good and our television people. At 9:15 a.m., the attack group met each day in the office of Charles Colson just down the hall from here. And at 4 p.m. each day, the news planning group met in the Roosevelt Room. Now, the news planning group had more to do with the president's own schedule than it did anything else, but the other scheduling activities, such as the speaking engagements of the cabinet officers, top White House staff, and other surrogates, was in effect dovetailed into the president's schedule and the first family's schedule. And the news planning group simply made sure that there weren't too many overlapping news activities. It made sure that on a day in which the president was very active, for example, that he carried the news out of the executive branch. By that I simply mean we would tone down or postpone other major news events coming out of the executive branch so that the president could have the lead in whenever he decided he wanted to do something publicly. So those are the three basic groups that I dealt with. Now, the news planning group also, of course, the campaign was on our minds, but the news planning group also, in effect, coordinated the public activities of the entire executive branch, including governmental news, straight governmental news that really had nothing to do with the campaign itself.
Would it be fair to say that this news planning group was, in essence, a continuation of what this Office of Communications had been doing over 69?
Yes, that's right. The basic function, of course, of this office is to coordinate public information throughout the executive branch and including the White House. So that certainly was an extension of the normal functions of this office.
Who were the people that met with you for that news planning group? Just offhand, the principals.
Charles Colson, Dick Moore, Pat Buchanan, John Scali, Dwight Chapin, Desmond Barker, and from time to time, and also Al Abrams from the committee to re-elect the president. And from time to time, Steve Bull and David Parker.
That's a pretty high-powered group. It's definitely a top-level people that we're meeting on that. How about the surrogate scheduling, Ken? Did you...
Well, now, we, as I said, the president, or actually the president and Bob Haldeman, inserted Chapin and I on as sort of the superstructure over that group. Sometime around midsummer, I believe, when it became apparent that neither Bart Porter nor Kurt Herge, who actually had the responsibility initially for that group, were performing their function as well as they ought to have. Now, I don't have any personal knowledge of the fact that they weren't performing their function as well as they ought to have. But it certainly was the president's judgment and Bob Haldeman's judgment that they were not. So Chapin and I were inserted into that group to give it new life and to make sure we were, in effect, the enforcers to make sure that that group exercised the discipline that apparently it hadn't been exercising in the past. But boiled down to its core, I think the group that we took over consisted of Porter, Herge, Andor. There were a couple of advance men in there, too. Who in the heck? John... I can see his face, but I can't remember his name.
Had he been part of the advance office operation?
Yes,
by that time?
John, somebody, short fellow, dark hair. And then one of Vice President Agnew's, his chief scheduler, was a member of that group, too, and I can't recall his name either. I just wasn't all that familiar with it. Job in that surrogate scheduling thing was to raise hell with them every morning at 8:30 to make sure that they were more afraid of me than they were of not doing their jobs.
So you would have been in a position to raise hell with them, supervise them. Would you have been in a position to say, do this, do that, schedule this person here or that person there?
Oh, yes. No, without question. Now, Chapin's function differed from that somewhat in that he wanted to maximize the campaign activities of the vice president and the first family. And so most of Dwight's concentration was in that area of increasing the number of public appearances of Mrs. Nixon, Tricia and Julie, and the two sons-in-law, as well as the vice president. My function was to make sure that surrogate X got to Philadelphia on time, and then when he got there, the press advance people were to get him a good crowd. And then key, of course, was that he said when he got there what it was we wanted to be said that day.
How many people did you have out on the campaign trail at any one time? Was it varied from day to day, didn't it?
Oh, sure. I would say that we averaged between 40 and 60 public appearances by the group we called surrogates every day.
So you might have as many as 40 to 60, not necessarily people, but that many appearances in the course of a day.
That's right.
And you would have overseen each and every one of those in terms of having had veto power over it or suggestions.
That's right. But let me make this clear to you. We had categories of surrogates. We had what we call first line surrogates and second line surrogates. Now, well, on a day where there would be 50 people that we considered surrogates speaking, the ones that I would take a personal interest in would be about 4 or 5. And those were in effect the three, four, five, depending on what day it was, people that we knew were our real heavyweights, number one, and also people who were, who specifically had to either attack or respond to a McGovern activity of some kind. I would take a personal interest in them for two reasons. The reason I just described, because they were key that day to our response. Or their position in the government was so high and their news value was so great that even though they were not specifically responding or attacking our opponent, their very newsworthiness made it essential that we take a personal interest in it. So it would be for one of those two reasons. Because the actual routine scheduling still remained at the committee to re-elect the president. I mean, among those 40 to 60 surrogates would be assistant secretaries of interior speaking before the Sierra Club. You know, that kind of thing. It went down that deep into the thing. And you knew damn well that they were going to make page one in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where they were speaking, but they certainly weren't going to make AP or UPI National Wire, nor were they going to make network television. So, but we also knew that out of that 40 to 60, there were four or five who had a damn good chance of making national news that day, and it would be those four or five I would concentrate on.
Would you be in direct contact with those four or five?
Oh, yes. Either I or Desmond Barker. He was one of our very good, what we call programmers, which is simply the guy who called up Cabinet Officer X the night before and the morning of his speech and said, here's our line and that kind of thing. So Des Barker did a lot of that direct contact, but I would also do some. And Charlie Colson would also do some too, especially in the attack area, where we knew that a cabinet officer, for example, was going out and we wanted him to take on some vulnerability of the opponent candidate. Colson would often do the programming himself in an attack situation.
Would you have been so involved that you might have even reviewed a speech draft or something else like that for some of these people?
Oh, not only that, we would have probably produced the speech draft.
And you yourself might have been involved in that too.
Oh yeah, I have, you see, it's kind of hard to separate the Office of Communications from the Colson operation during the campaign period. For example, Ken Kachigian wrote many speeches during that period. David Gergen wrote many speeches during that period. And we had four or five other writers who did from time to time. So, so when I would say we produce it, it would be... Well, I guess I own part of Ken Kachigian. I'm talking from a structural point of view. I own part of Ken Kachigian and part of David Gergen. Colson owned part of them, too. It was that kind of a thing. There was an intermingling, let's put it that way. It was hard to draw the line in certain instances as to where they belonged here or where they belonged to the Colson operation.
So you might have called up Ken and said, Cabinet member so-and-so is going to be speaking at such and such a place, and here's the thought. Thrust of the speech.
The theme of it,
yes.
Okay. And then, yes, we would have reviewed that, and then we would have gone the step further. We would have then probably sent by messenger a draft of that document to the surrogate who was to deliver it. And then Colson or I or Des Barker, or any one of the three of us, might have then called up that same individual and talked him through the speech draft that he had, that we had prepared.
You did put in some long hours during that campaign, then, obviously. Would you have been coordinating each one of these top liners with Colson and Barker and Chapin and other people, or would they have simply been your responsibility to carry through on, let's say, whatever that day's activities were?
Well, at the way that actually took place was that at the attack group meeting in the morning, we would know that there were two or three issues that were very important from a news point of view that day. And during the course of the attack group meeting, we would have assigned the responsibility, for example, to produce what we called the resource material. That would be the speech or the insert or simply a fact sheet that refuted what the opponent had said. And also at that meeting in the morning, we would have agreed. Let's say, for example, we had four issues that we had to deal with that day that were pretty hot. Well, collectively we would decide the four people, and sometimes it was more than that. Sometimes we might put two people on one issue that we thought was very important. But let's say that to address ourselves to these four issues, we decided we needed seven of our people to address themselves to the four issues. Well, we would also decide that morning, let's say that issue number one was a defense issue, bug out of the old, I forget the issues now, frankly, but let's say McGovern had said, let's bug out of Vietnam, which he said often. Well, we might have decided to put three people on that. We might have put the Secretary of Defense on that. We might have put the Secretary, Henry Kissinger, who at the time was an assistant to the President for National Security. And we might have decided to put a third person, like, for example, John Eisenhower, who was a surrogate and who had nothing to do with the government, lives out in Pennsylvania and writes books and so forth. Well, at the time we designated in our minds those three people, we would have also said, now, Colson, you're responsible for getting Mel Laird to take this on. Dez, you're responsible for John Eisenhower. And Clausen, you're responsible for Henry Kissinger. So in effect, we had, once the responder had been designated, then we had in effect an action man to make damn sure he did it, and did it in the way that we decided that was best to be done.
So the resource material would have been prepared, and would it have generally been similar for all three of these?
Usually it would be identical. Because one of the things that we always gave the surrogates the option to do, and that is that the best and most effective resource material would be a basic speech, a basic fact sheet. We would then, those of us who would then have the action on that particular issue, would then go to Melvin Laird or Henry Kissinger or John Eisenhower and say, now this is the basic line that you must take today. But take these basic facts and put them into your own language if you want to. That was a more effective way for us to deal with it than to try to write three separate speeches for three different surrogates. So they would then take the core of that speech or the core of that fact sheet and then put it into Lairdese or Kissingerese and go ahead and do it. And that way it did not appear, and we were very much concerned about that, it did not appear that we were orchestrating down to the last comma and semicolon. And as a matter of fact, since nobody caught us, I assume we were effective the whole way, because nobody realized that this was the mechanics of how it was done. The best cartoon of the 72 campaign is right up there, and it tells more about our operation than anything that I can tell you in detail.
Is that out of the Post? Is that a...
No, it's out of another newspaper. But it shows McGovern watching the television with a terribly distressed look on his face, and the line says, in response to Senator McGovern's charge that President Nixon does not care enough about Israel, White House Gardener Saul Steinberg said today. Well, that was the essence of our whole plan. I mean, we had Manolo Sanchez out doing Spanish-speaking radio in Chicago and Los Angeles and San Antonio, Texas. I sent my administrative assistant, Ed Blecksmith, along with him as his press man through this tour. And of course, what was happening here, and something that the press never caught on to, they never caught on to, and to this day they haven't caught on to it in detail, is that we were pricking McGovern with 1,000 needles a day. Now, some of those needles, when we'd roll out a major governmental official to take him on, that was a big needle. But even when that was taking place, as I told you, if you had 60 people out speaking today, five of them were high governmental officials who commanded the news. But 55 other administration people, ranging all the way from Saul Steinberg, the gardener, talking about Israel, to Manolo Sanchez talking about how much the president loved the Spanish speaking, it was 1,000 tiny pinpricks every day of the week. And it's something that McGovern's people could never adjust to, because they couldn't understand that when they would go into a town, the plane would land at the airport, they would walk out, they would hold their press conference, one of their press aides would pick up the local paper and find that yesterday, somebody from the administration had been in that town and had called McGovern a jerk. and it was page one news. And all that the local press was interested in asking McGovern was to respond to yesterday's story. And of course, we did that deliberately. We made sure. We called it the sandwich theory. We made sure that an administration spokesman hit every city that McGovern went to the day before he got there and the day after he left.
You actually did that throughout the campaign?
Throughout the campaign. You see, that's why McGovern's traveling press corps never realized what the hell was taking place. And it's funny that they didn't, because they're not that dumb. But you see, the traveling press corps we knew was isolated with the candidate. All they know about are the position papers that he passes out on the airplane. They know what he says when he goes into a crowd situation. In effect, the public utterances and the public positions of this candidate. But what the traveling national press corps never realized was that we set up McGovern in every town he ever went to. And the local press corps, most cities have two newspapers, and most cities have four television stations, and most cities have somewhere between 8 and 20 radio stations. When McGovern would hit St. Paul, Minnesota, the traveling press corps would be sitting there listening to McGovern say whatever he was going to say for national consumption. But when he go into the press conference situation, what they never understood was why the St. Paul press corps was asking McGovern about why he didn't support grain allotments in 1932, or why he opposed why did he vote against a park bill that would have established a park in St. Paul 2 years ago in the Senate? Well, the reason they were asking those questions is that we had somebody from the Department of Agriculture into St. Paul the day before and had accused McGovern of all of these malicious things that affected the people of St. Paul and the state of Minnesota. And so the traveling press corps would get irritated. They would look down their nose at these stupid St. Paul reporters. Why are they not asking him about Vietnam, and why are they not asking him about amnesty, and why aren't they asking about that? Well, the reason they weren't was because they all had on their news shows yesterday and in the papers this morning what our guy had accused him of the day before. Then, when McGovern would then make his four-hour appearance in St. Paul, and away he would go. And there would always be, of course they'd report what he said at the airport, but there'd always be another story that he didn't satisfactorily answer why he voted against grain allotments in 32 and why he didn't like the park system in St. Paul. And then the following day there would be another administration guy in there. And what was he talking about? Why he didn't vote for the grain allotment, why he didn't vote for the park system. Because the people in St. Paul didn't give a shit about Vietnam and amnesty and things like that. What they cared about were the local issues, and our surrogates brought those local issues to every city that he went to.
And the traveling press never picked that up. No. Never saw the link.
That's
similarity.
Right. It shows how isolated the traveling press corps really is. And then, of course, for months, and I mean this literally, for months, the Washington Press Corps wrote about how the president was sitting on his ass in the White House not campaigning. And we were running the biggest, most extensive campaign in the history of this country at the same time they were writing about the president sitting on his ass in the White House. I finally told one old-time reporter after I knew we had this thing locked, I said, you know, you sat around for months watching the White House. And when you didn't see anything taking place there, you said we weren't doing anything. And you were a fool, because we were doing more than any other president has ever done.
Well, I suppose it's difficult for me to see how anybody could have been so naive to have overlooked all of this activity out in the hinterlands. But I guess that's because I was within the complex and I had contact with some of the people. Know a little bit about Creep's operation.
Well, Creep's operation, you know, I was so close that my judgment isn't as good as it, but it was characterized by two types of persons. and all you have to do is to look at all of the names and understand that it was characterized staffed by people who had had a chance at the White House and had failed. It was also staffed by very young people who had not been at the White House, but who were told in no uncertain terms that if you do extraordinarily well during this campaign, the chances are you may end up on the White House staff. So in effect, you had the two qualities. For those who had been at the White House and had turned out to be either mediocre or had failed in their functions, that exercise, the exercise of being at CREP during the campaign, was a second chance for those people to get back to the White House and get back to the White House with some luster that had since worn off on that first tour. So you really had some terribly ambitious, but I'm afraid not very bright people over there.
And well, I wasn't that close to it, but I can appreciate what you're saying, Ken. There are a couple that I knew well enough to know they fit that description.
Yeah. Well, the only two examples, of course, that I can give you firsthand are the press office, which was just awful. I mean, whoever decided that Devan Shumway knew anything about press had to have a hole in his head. But on the other hand, it fits my definition because he had been over here and had done very badly. And he was sent over there, presumably, to rehabilitate himself. But the fact that we actually had to insert Abrams over there midway in the campaign to take charge, I think, indicates how bad it was. And then the surrogate scheduling operation under Porter and Herge was in exactly the same boat. We finally had to put White House, in effect, what we call White House discipline on them, because they just weren't hacking it on their own.
Well, you were a busy man then from the time you joined in February 72 through the campaign. Your regular contacts with the members of the press corps were probably not very great during that period.
Well, a different category of press. Basic function of this office, which held true during the campaign, was contacts with editors, publishers, editorial writers, broadcast executives, and syndicated columnists. Now, that's always been true about this office. Now, we were very active with syndicated columnists, editorial writers, and this whole group that I'm mentioning to you is we use an umbrella term called opinion makers. You see, this office job function has always been to influence what the press produces in its editorial pages and in syndicated columns. The press office over on the West Wing, its function has been simply to put out what we call public information. But nothing that this office has ever done has been anything but to take the public information that we put out in the press office and put the president's perspective on that information and to try to convince people who write opinion articles and who do opinion pieces on radio and television that what we have done is a good thing for the country. So we stayed, we did have a great deal of press contact, but not with reporters, but just with people who write opinion.
Well, I'm glad you drew that distinction. It was obviously cloudy in my mind. Well then, were you on the phone with these people? Were you meeting them face to face?
Oh yes, well, the forerunner of Cocktails with Clausen, which became a later institutionalization of this office, took place all during the 72 campaign. We would bring in one-on-one, we would bring in 10 syndicated columnists during that period and put them with one of our people who had something to say. And he would try to persuade them of the rightness of our position as opposed to what our opponent was doing during that period of time. Now the difference is that all of those sessions were held on background during the campaign, and the Cocktails with Clausen thing were all on the record, and the guy could be quoted by name later on and so forth, and what he said. But during the campaign, we did them on background, and the columns would say, a high official of the government told this columnist that. That was really the basic difference. But we had those small press sessions all during the campaign.
I could continue asking some more questions on this, but I probably should move on. You've been very good about filling me in depth on that. What happened after the campaign? Was there a big drop off, a letdown?
Yeah, well, the thing that affected me most was the fact that when the campaign was over with, you know, we went through the everybody turns in his resignation jazz, and two things happened that greatly affected our operation. One of the things on the positive side was that John Ehrlichman had seen this operation performed during the campaign and was very much impressed by it, and knew that its prime 99% of its function had to do with domestic activities. I mean, after all, that's even domestic politics boils down to taking a domestic issue and spinning out of it the best political position that the president can get out of it. And John asked if our operation could be tailored, because he had some plans for the restructuring of the executive branch after the election. I'm sure you're familiar with them, or will be before you get through with this thing. It boiled down to an extreme centralization of authority in the White House on the substantive domestic issues. In other words, John and the president were going to call the shots even more directly than they had in the past, and they had done it rather directly before that. But it was really a tightening up of the executive branch. And John saw in his process that my operation would in effect be the merchandiser of those domestic issues. I mean, if you take the premise that he was going to draw the domestic substance into the White House even more than it had been before, then it made equal sense that the selling of those issues should be directed just as tightly from the White House as the decisions on the substance of those domestic activities. So he saw in my operation a merchandising of domestic issues. And that's sort of how we started out in 1973. From a bad point of view, or at least from my own point of view, Ron Ziegler had chafed under this dual press system under Klein. As you probably know, this title and this office was created initially in 69 just to take care of Klein so they wouldn't have to kick him out and send him back to California. Well, and as I've told you, from 72 on, I was the director of the Office of Communications even then. Well, when I got here, I found out that before me, Charlie Colson had actually been the director of communications. And before that, Haldeman horsed around with Magruder and tried four or five other experiments, simply because Klein, while he was a great speaker and a hell of a surrogate, was the world's worst manager of men and activities. And this was simply, apparently, been going on since almost the beginning in 69. To try to get Herb to stop trying to manage and to let him do what he did best, which was speak and appear in public. And they had fooled around with this management aspect of this thing for apparently a long time. And I ended up being finally the manager in 72. But it was only after Colson took his shot and found out that he didn't know any more about the press than anybody else knew about it that he finally yielded this thing and I took it over. Well, knowing with the background of what I've just said to you, you can see that with Klein running around all over the country speaking and meeting editors and publishers and things like that, and poor old Ziegler confined to this press room every day getting his ears knocked off, that Ziegler's position in this was awful, because publicly Klein always treated Ziegler like a little boy, when in effect Ziegler was working his tail off over here in very difficult circumstances, and Klein was eating filet mignon and drinking martinis, you know, with the bosses of the very people that Ziegler was trying to deal with over here. So, in the beginning of 73, Ziegler sought, and in one hand I agreed with him, sought to consolidate the two operations. And he did it on paper. They were consolidated in early 73. with Ziegler being the prime communications guy. And on one hand, I felt and still feel that it was the kind of reaction that I would have made too had I had to spend 4 years playing second fiddle to a guy who really wasn't doing anything substantive at all. But on the other hand, I knew that Ziegler didn't know anything about the press. His 4 years had not taught him a goddamn thing. So while the consolidation took place on paper, it never took place in reality. In other words, I fought Ziegler tooth and nail from the beginning of 73 about the consolidation, and we never actually let it take place. And then when the Watergate crap hit in the spring of 73, a couple of things happened. One of the things was that we were isolated over here. We were not part of it at all. And Ziegler was indeed in charge of all of I'm talking about the press. I'm always talking about only the press aspect of this thing. And we went through the summer of 73, and if you recall that period, you must realize that nothing that Ziegler did anything but crumble into dust in his hands. I mean, I've never seen a guy from a press point of view do the wrong thing every time. Now, Hayden had come on after the Haldeman-Ehrlichman exit, and it wasn't until about September of 73 that Hague said, "Hey, what the hell is going on here?" And he called me over to his office one day and said, "What role are you guys playing in the Watergate thing?" And I said, we have gone back since the beginning of 73 to the regular governmental functions of the Office of Communications, the way it was when it was first created. And we have only been doing the governmental, what I call the proper governmental coordination since then, because Ziegler won't let us do anything else. He wants to handle the Watergate aspect all by himself. And Hague said, "You mean that he's been doing this all by himself since it happened?" And I said, "Yeah." Hague said, "Well, that answers my question as to why it's being done so badly. That son of a bitch doesn't know anything about the press." So, we started, by that time, the fight that had taken place in January and February of 73 and March had now gone down to a kind of a mutual sullenness. My operation was doing the routine governmental stuff and deciding that we couldn't win the fight and that was the only function we could perform. And Ziegler was handling the Watergate thing all by himself over there, never telling us anything that was taking place. And so in September, when Hague said that to me, it gave us a kind of a renewed hope that maybe Hague has now been here long enough and he understands this thing well enough so that we can get back into a piece of the action. So the fight renewed, and we still couldn't get a piece of the action. And even though Hague was talking to us more and more favorably, because every time he'd pick up his paper in the morning, there was another press disaster. We went through the Saturday Night Massacre with Ziegler still totally in charge of that aspect of it. And I think that was the straw that broke his back. Because in December of 73, when we went to San Clemente, it was clear that there were going to be some massive changes. And there were. They didn't come as well as... By the way, this is only for the old man's eyes, isn't it?
Yeah. Treat this just like any... You know, instead of writing the memo.
All right. In December of 73, I thought that on the merits, Ziegler had fucked up so badly that we could take over, we could do two things. Number one, that we could rejuvenate this office back into the political communications operation that I had run during the campaign. And number two, I thought that we could get rid of Ziegler and that I could run the press office. Now, by that I don't mean become press secretary, because I never wanted to do that. But what I wanted to do was to have overall communications responsibility and to have my man act as press secretary, which meant that we would start programming him out of this office the same way we had programmed our surrogates during the campaign. Now, we didn't achieve that in December, although Haig recommended that Ziegler be fired. The old man by that time, I think, had begun to treat Ron like a nephew, which is the way he had been treating him all the way up to that point. And that's where his strength lay. That was one of the frustrations of the period, because I knew that we weren't winning or losing on the merits, that the merits had nothing to do with it. That he had that connection, and that was the thing that was keeping him alive, and that was the thing that was going to continue to keep him alive. But at any rate, despite that, we made a hard run at it in December. And this is what finally took place. No, the old man would not fire Ziegler. But he would give me and my operation the entire authority to run things, except the press office. In other words, we could go back to being exactly the same kind of unit we were during the 72 campaign, with the exception that we could not program the press office, which was part of our proposal. That Ziegler continued to have authority over the press office, and he continued to have the direct access to the president on the nephew business. But otherwise, we could roll. Now, by that time, my operation was cut down to about 12 people. Because all we were doing was governmental stuff. And I immediately, upon coming back from San Clemente in January of 74, started hiring. And I hired a new deputy, Jimmy Holland from HEW. I hired Larry Speaks, who was Senator Eastland's press secretary. I brought Bruce Hershenson into my staff. I got authority over John McLaughlin from Haig. Let's see, what else did we do? I had John Carlson already on the staff. I made Elizabeth O'Neill, who was my administrative assistant, a staff assistant, gave her responsibilities for women's press activities in the complex. At any rate, we zoomed from about 12 to 28 people within a month. And, the key thing about this in the restructuring, in effect, we took away all of the substantive press activities away from Ziegler, except the press office. The other thing, and the key to this, is that the new operation got restructured directly under the chief of staff, which is where it was when I first came here. In effect, Haig became my Haldeman again. And so we reported directly to the chief of staff, and that was an important structural change.
Then you would probably have been in contact with Haig on a daily basis, frequently, in fact.
Always, ever since then, as a matter of fact. Now, at that point, it was kind of an interesting thing, because the animosity between Ziegler and I almost immediately stopped. And one of the reasons that it stopped was this, is that for all of his mistakes, you know, that had been taking place over that previous year, he had been catching holy hell from the old man, of course. And I'm sure that it was that in addition to the affection and the closeness and so forth, obviously the president finally came to the decision at the end of 73 that he just, as much as he loved Ron, it was clear he couldn't do it. But when we took over the responsibility from him, then the hell-raising from the old man stopped, of course, because then he was no longer responsible for it. And I think that was a great weight off his shoulders, finally. I mean, just as any of us, and I'm trying to be as fair about this as possible, as any of us doesn't like things taken away from him, and that's what Ron was fighting for. On the other hand, it must have been a great relief to him, too, not to have to take those everyday kick in the groins about why did this happen and why did that happen sort of thing. And let's see, on January the 18th, I inaugurated the thing called Cocktails with Clausen, and we had 74 of those before the boss quit.
I wouldn't know how many, 74.
Yeah. And that was bringing in 15 reporters, columnists, editors, putting them in our conference room right next door here with a top official of the administration and having an hour-long on-the-record interview. And we got great press out of those things. Now, the reason that I put that in immediately was because by that time, by January of 74, the atmosphere in the West Wing briefing room was so poisonous and so bad that it wouldn't have made any difference if we had announced the second coming of Christ. Those reporters would have just taken Jerry Warren's balls off for it. So we decided to come over here and to create an atmosphere that was a lot more informal. That's why the cocktails business, I figured that with a glass in their hand. And also, the second thing was that we made them all sit down over here. Because as I watched that press room deteriorate over the months over there, it was pretty clear to me that the standing up over a long period of time, the shoulder-to-shoulder business, had a great deal to do with the terrible animosity over there. So we brought them over here in small groups. We sat them down. We gave them a drink of whiskey and said, you know, here's an hour. It's all on the record. You can quote everything you hear. God bless you. Go to it. Enjoy yourselves. And it worked. And 74 of them worked.
And those ran about an hour each?
Yes. About an hour each.
Longer if the
longer if they wanted to. We didn't. We never put a time limit on it. And then afterwards, if the guest had said anything that the television people thought was newsworthy, then each time we offered to have the guest walk over on the front lawn of the White House and do a stand-up television interview based on what he had said earlier over here. So it really took care of both the print and the television, electronic media.
Did any of the news people bring tape recorders in to
Yes.
tape record the sessions?
Yes, and the funny thing about this is that they were so accustomed to this thing that had developed over here, is that they would threaten me initially, the first five or six of these things. They would say, I'm going to bring a tape recorder. Are you going to bar me from doing that? I'd say, no, hell no, bring a tape recorder if you want to. Television people would say, why won't you let us do an interview with this guy on camera? What are you bringing us over here and making us sit down with these pencil pushers and say, of course you can have an interview with him on camera. As soon as it's over with, you can take him over and have it. We can. You know, we went through all sorts of things like that before after five or six of these things. These guys said, my God, these things are pretty good. We've never talked to Roy Ash before or, you know, to Al Haig or people like that.
Did you have any trouble getting the administration people to come down?
Initially, we did. Initially we did, and I started off modestly because I wanted to prove that it worked. You see, I had taken the, as you know, I'm a professional journalist. The way that press room has run ever since I have been here has just been incredible to me. You know, one of the things that I know because I am a professional journalist is this, is that you always take less risk when you talk on the record than you do when you talk on what they call background. And the reason you take less risk is that if a man knows that he's being quoted every word that he says, he's a hell of a lot more cautious in what, I'm talking about from our point of view now, he's a hell of a lot more cautious in what he says than when he knows his name is not going to be attached to what he says. And of course from a professional point of view, I knew that all along. But originally, I had to prove to the, in effect, the top strata of the White House staff that was so. So I started off, I believe, with Ken Cole and Fred Malik and guys like that I knew weren't even in areas where they could possibly put their foot in their mouths, really. And when those started working, and then I guess guest number three, I put us over the hump because it was David Eisenhower. David Eisenhower, I think, was guest number three. And he did it on the record, as Cole and Malik had done. And when David Eisenhower did it, it got great press. It was a hell of a coverage, television, wires, everybody. And that, the moment that the David Eisenhower thing was finished, it was almost as if all the doubters subsided. And after that, the press got so good on these things over here that I actually had assistance to the president and cabinet officers pleading with me to let them come over here and do this thing. It was amazing. We didn't have a single negative story out of any of the 74 sessions over here.
Were there ever administration people who refused to come over?
Only one, the president's press secretary.
Are you serious?
That's all. He was the only one. When this interview is over, I will show you over the next door some of the photographs that we had. We had photographs taken, by the way.
I've seen one photograph of all of the people sitting down.
Okay, well, let me just, you can look over the list. You will find that every cabinet officer came. every member of the Council of Economic Advisors, every top White House guy, assistant to the president, counselor to the president, a lot of agency heads. Only one guy refused to come.
That's hard to believe, Ken. It really is.
That's it.
As far as the...
And Gerry Ford was number 50, by the way, as vice president. We invited him to the 50th session.
I think the photograph that I saw was of Gerry Ford sitting down with the members of the press. What did the other people in your office do? Were they...
Let me ask you a question.
What time is it?
It's 10 after 12.
I'm sorry, I don't have my watch. And we generally cut these things off at 12. I mean, after 1 hour.
Okay. Well, if you want to come back, you're welcome to.
Really?
Oh, sure. If this will be helpful to you.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
At approximately 5 minutes after 12, the interview session was stopped to allow Mr. Clausen to take a break for lunch, and we agreed to meet again at 3 o'clock this afternoon. We went over into his conference room to look at signed photographs showing the various people that came to speak to members of the news media. One of the photographs was of a meeting that St. Clair, James St. Clair, attended. Mr. Clausen pointed out that all of Mr. St. Clair's meetings with the press took place in these type conferences, and Mr. Clausen indicated that that was symbolic of the new role that Mr. Clausen's office assumed, that it was from this office that information on the Watergate matter was being disseminated. The cartoon on the wall in Mr. Clausen's office that he referred to and that he quoted from was a cartoon out of the Charlotte Observer. The cartoonist's name, as near as I can tell, was a Mr. Marlette. There appears no date on the cartoon, so I can't date it. I believe that wraps up the comments that I have now, and hopefully we'll continue at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
After we finished up over here, you took me over in the other room and showed me those photographs, and you pointed out one that showed Mr. St. Clair talking to members of the press. What was it that you thought was noteworthy about that, Ken?
Well, to the best of my recollection, all of St. Clair's contact with the press were under the aegis of this office. I don't recall the exact dates, but I do know that he did three smaller press sessions in my conference room, as well as one full-scale press conference in room 450 of the old executive office building. In addition to that, I assigned one of my staff members, Larry Speaks, to act as Mr. St. Clair's press secretary, a role that he had from the from probably March until Mr. St. Clair resigned from the administration.
Were there other members of the White House press or of the White House office that spoke to the press solely through your office as opposed to other places? In other words, did it eventually become customary to think in terms of this office as being the medium through which they met with the press?
Yes, a handful, and on strictly Watergate-related matters, I think you can legitimately say that Mr. St. Clair used this office completely. Dean Birch, at the time a counselor to the president, also spoke under the sponsorship, I guess that would be the right way, of this office in his numerous Watergate appearances. and also Pat Buchanan, and ultimately I did myself in the waning days of Watergate, in which we found that it was more and more difficult to get administration people to articulate the president's position on Watergate. Ultimately, I had to go into the role of spokesman myself, and that was particularly true during the Middle East and the Russian trips, where during both of those trips, Mr. Buchanan, Mr. Birch, and I sort of alternated as the administration spokesman, but all of that was arranged by my office.
Let me move on to some other questions that are more perfunctory, but at least it will help tie down some loose ends. In terms of documentation of all of your activities, to what degree were the documents that I think have already been picked up, keep a record of what you've done while you've been here since February 72?
Well, what you picked up was the second batch, actually, of documents. I turned over a huge batch of documents right after the November election on instructions from the Chief of Staff, Bob Haldeman, at the time. Those of us who were deeply involved in the president's reelection activities turned over an initial batch of what we called campaign-related documents. So what you have here is a second batch. I would suspect probably less documentation than other offices. In the first place, I didn't believe very much in memo writing. So I would suspect less than you might have gotten from other offices.
So now the three different meetings that you talked about that occurred on a daily basis during the campaign, the surrogate scheduling, would there be much documentation that would show your input into that or your responsibilities for it?
Yes, and that would have all been turned over in the initial batch of post-election stuff.
And as far as this attack group type meeting?
Well, that's one of the things that I'm really not familiar with, because as the chairman of the attack group, it was Colson's job to report the activities of the group. So I suspect that most of my activities relating to the attack group are probably included in Colson memos to Haldeman, I would suspect.
And then the news planning group, that, as you said, was a continuation of what this office had been doing all along.
That's right. No, there was never it was such a day-to-day process that I would suspect that there aren't a great deal of papers involving that. It was usually what we do tomorrow sort of thing.
So 50 years from now, your footprints are going to fade a little bit if all we have to go on are the documentation or the documents and records. Would that be a fair assumption?
There is one specific activity for which there is, considerable documentation. Interestingly enough, it has to do with what I call a straight governmental activity as opposed to an election year thing. And that would be in the council's office. I had direction of an activity in the spring of 1973 that came to be known as the Battle of the Budget, in which we used the same techniques, public opinion techniques, under my direction, that had been done so successfully during the campaign, including the production of a thick volume entitled Battle of the Budget that contained speeches and fact sheets and other information relating to the president's desire to hold down the budget. The reason that there's a lot of documentation on that and in the council's office is because Ralph Nader sued me over that campaign, and I became the only administration figure to ever defeat Nader in a suit. And his contention was that we were using taxpayers' money to lobby on behalf of legislation. And ultimately that was dropped, the suit was dropped after I agreed to withdraw the book. I only agreed to withdraw the book because the circuit we had, we sustained nine straight presidential vetoes as a result of that campaign. And at that point, we got into a much more compromising mood with Congress. So with the, I withdrew it for practical reasons. I withdrew it because it was outmoded in view of our new attitude towards Congress. But of course, when I withdrew the document, then Nader's suit was sort of mooted. And so we ended up off the hook on that. But I did do a deposition in that suit, in which I talked about the activities of this office and my own activities and the necessity of a president of the United States being able to communicate with its citizens. And that deposition is probably a very valuable document for your purposes, because although the specific question was the battle of the budget and what we were doing on the battle of the budget, I think when you read my deposition on the matter, you can see how it would have been equally applicable during the campaign, how it was, how it did apply on the straight governmental program, and probably it gives you the best picture of what this operation actually does. I recall in the deposition that we went all the way back to Steve Early, who had my job in the first Roosevelt administration, and it wasn't called the Office of Communications, but in effect, Steve Early did for Roosevelt about what I did for President Nixon. And I pointed out in the deposition that Early really did exactly the same thing that I was doing, and that therefore there was a tradition of this sort of marshaling of public opinion and getting the governmental people to say publicly what the president's perspective on an issue was. And Nader's retort in court was, "I know that Steve Early used to do this, but you do it so much better than Steve Early did." So I think that that deposition, which is in the Office of Legal Counsel, and the Nader suit, and also the book called Battle of the Budget, would probably be useful and probably would provide some of the best documentation of just what are the mechanics of going about doing what this office does.
You mentioned several people that were your lieutenants, let's say after the 72 campaign. Is there any way to get some feel for their specific responsibilities, Ken?
Sure. My deputy, James Holland, I hired from, I first hired him for HEW and then took him away from HEW. His basic function was the basic governmental coordination of public information between the departments and agencies and the various entities in the White House. Harold Weinbaugh, whom I hired after he retired from the FBI, where he was an inspector and J. Edgar Hoover's public relations man, even though he was not called J. Edgar Hoover's public relations man, had primary responsibility for dealing directly with syndicated columnists and also for setting up seminars, which we held on issues in room 450. Starting initially when I came here in 72, the seminars were initially designed to have an effect on the election, but they were so successful during 72 that we continued them on straight governmental issues, and I'll give you a couple of examples. We brought in, this is after the election, we brought in all of the financial and economic writers in the country, a group of about 150, into room 450, and we in effect sponsored a seminar lasting all day that included all of the major economic officials in the executive branch. We did another session with health and science writers, another group of over between 100 and 150, in which we had an all-day thing on using everybody from the Surgeon General to whoever the top man is in the Pentagon on that, and then a lot of HEW people who had various aspects of health and science. We've done the same thing on the subject of housing with urban affairs reporters. And the idea simply is that I send out a telegram saying that President Nixon invites you to the White House for a day-long seminar on this subject. You are your newspaper or television or radio station specialist in this area. And sign Ken Clausen, and that brings them in. And then we really do produce the top experts in the administration in that particular field. and they've been highly successful. And as I said, during the campaign, for example, we distorted this a little bit. And for example, I had all of the editors of domestic Jewish publications in during the campaign. And of course, their speakers were Herbert Stein and Caspar Weinberger and Henry Kissinger and Ken Clausen, you know, that sort of thing. And then I brought in another time all of the religious editors in the country. This was during the 72 election that these ethnic type seminars were held. But it was successful during the campaign for political reasons. But the point that I make to you is that they were successful. And spinning out of the 72 election, where your 95% of your motive was political, came the governmental seminars, which were just as successful, by the way, except they were done by issue instead of by voting block group or however you want to put it.
How many of these did you have?
I'd say during the 72 campaign, I put on probably 20.
And then after that?
And then since the 72 election, that would be all of 73, and thus far in 74, I think probably 10. These are massive undertakings, of course, since people are coming from all parts of the country. And then I would usually cap it off with a reception over at the Blair House or over at Talo House for the group that had come in. And then we would have the top White House staff come to the reception that did not participate, come to the reception and mingle with these writers.
So Harold Linebaugh was the guy that haunted
He was what I call the project man on the seminars and so forth. And then, of course, I have Alvin Snyder, who was my television scheduling fellow. As you may or may not know, my office schedules all network television, network, and the key is network television, for all members of the executive branch, including the White House. By that, I simply mean that if you were out in Dayton, Ohio, going on local television, my office would not have anything to do with it. But if you wanted to go on Issues and Answers, or meet the press, or be interviewed on the CBS Morning News, or the Today Show, or even do an interview for the nightly news shows of the various networks, my office does the scheduling for those appearances.
Is that a situation where they call up and say, we've got a slot on Issues and Answers for 2 weeks from now, who might you be interested in?
That's right. It happens two ways. In dealing directly with the networks, the producers of the various news shows will call here and say, we'd like to have Secretary Jones, assistant to the President Smith, or sometimes they'll even call and say, we'd like an administration spokesman in the area of the economy, housing, something like that. But most of the time they'll call and ask for a specific member of the administration. Now that's one way that it works. The second way it works is that the networks will go directly to the individual that they want on the show. And they will say, Secretary Jones, this is producer Smith of NBC, and we'd like to invite you on Meet the Press on Sunday. In that case, the cabinet officer or the White House, the administration person on the executive branch will then call here and say, I've been invited to appear on this network show. Is it advisable from the White House point of view? And normally, because I am a member of the senior staff and attend the senior staff meetings and so forth, I'll usually know off the top of my head whether we're selling the economy this week or something else. And of course, keeping abreast of the news, you know how controversial it's going to be, probably in advance. And you then, in cases where I had questions, and we had questions frequently on the Watergate aspect of these television appearances, my normal format would be to discuss the offer and the pros and cons of what we could get out of such an appearance with the Chief of Staff, Alexander Haig. And then between the two of us, we would decide whether to give the administration official the go signal or not. Or in some cases, of course, what we would do is that we might think that the person that the networks wanted was too controversial at that moment. And we might say, we cannot deliver Secretary Jones to you for this appearance, but would you consider taking Secretary Smith instead? That kind of negotiations and trade-off is a normal process of dealing with the networks. And then, of course, one of the things that I don't think very many people know about, and that is that my conference room in here for the last year has been the site of most of the one-on-one television network interviews. the kind of thing where Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather or Tom Gerald or any other network correspondent would interview an administration personality. One of the functions of that conference room was to set up for the exclusive one-on-one type interview. Oftentimes, when the consumer price index comes out, for example, or the wholesale price index, we would simply bring Herb Stein down into our conference room and have him be interviewed by Irving R. Levine of NBC or some other economic type reporter. So that conference room has been used a great deal for that kind of thing.
So Snyder's main responsibility is the network scheduling.
That's right. And now, after Ziegler lost Mark Good, who was in effect the president's technician, Al did pick up that Mark Good responsibility in addition to his television schedule.
That's where Helen Collins,
that's right,
Mark's secretary, came.
That's right. Now let me go around the horn a little bit. Bruce Hershenson, of course, was the Office of Communications liaison man with all Nixon support groups. Now, in that area, we overlapped with Bill Baruti, who had basic responsibility for special interest groups. But I assigned Hershenson to this task on the Watergate-related support groups. That would be, and his biggest one, of course, was Rabbi Korff. Now, there was just simple logic in that. It seemed to me that Hershenson, a Jew, could deal with Rabbi Korff, a Jew, a hell of a lot better than Baruti, a Catholic Lebanese, could deal with Rabbi Korff. And Hershenson did not only Rabbi Korff, but most of the other Watergate-related support groups. He was my liaison man with that. And in addition to that, of course, Hershenson made speeches, made television appearances, and also wrote articles, which that's another function of this office, by the way, is the placement of written articles signed by a member of the executive branch in leading newspapers and magazines around the country. Whenever you see an article signed by Cabinet Officer X on the New York Times op-ed page, usually the first draft of that article was written here in this office, sent to the Cabinet Officer, who himself or one of his own men revised it to his liking, but keeping the core of the article. He would then sign it, ship it back here, and then we would place it with the New York Times or any other newspaper in the country.
Would your files reflect those drafts, Ken, or some, would they reflect in any way that initial effort on the part of this office to get a cabinet member to?
Sure. Elizabeth O'Neill, whose office is right down the hall from here and who was my administrative assistant, was in charge of what we called op-ed pieces, which is simply administration articles, and I'm sure her files would have both early drafts and finished products and some sort of a documentation on how many were placed, how many were offered, and how many actually were published, that kind of thing.
Was Bruce brought on primarily to do this liaison with RN support groups?
No, he wasn't. As a matter of fact, he was brought on initially by Haldeman as a kind of a second team Dick Moore, whose job it was to write any ideas he might have down on paper and submit them to Haldeman as ideas for what the president might be doing publicly and what others might be doing publicly. And in about August of September of 1973, word filtered back to me that Hershenson was on the verge of being fired, because by that time Haldeman had gone, and really Haig was a different kind of fellow than Haldeman, much more interested in substantive input than he was concepts, ideas, pie-in-the-sky type thing, which was Hershenson's forte. And I had become so impressed with Bruce over the year that I had seen him operate near me but outside my jurisdiction, that when I found that he was on the verge of being fired, I went to Haig and made an appeal that Hershenson be kept and assigned to me, and that I would find productive work in Haig's mold for Hershenson. And therefore I assigned him to as a liaison man to support groups, because that was just beginning to to become a factor at that point. And I thought Hirschenson would be splendid at the job, and suggested that he be made a part of my staff and do that work, and Haig approved it. Now, McLaughlin was also on the verge of being fired at the time, simply because he never was a speechwriter. I don't know what he originally was, but during the whole time I knew him, he was not a speechwriter, even though he called himself a speechwriter. And I also pleaded with Haig and got McLaughlin kept on these grounds. McLaughlin's constituency was very hardcore right-wing constituency, which I felt we needed very badly as we went into the tougher days of the Watergate saga involving the president. If there was one thing that we needed to do, was to maintain for the president a hardcore of very, very loyal people. And I perceived that to be the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. And as a result of having Haig permit me to keep McLaughlin, I kept him on the road almost continuously, speaking primarily to right wing groups. And he did that, and did it extraordinarily effectively. He kept that hardcore support very well, I thought. Now, beyond that, he was a wild man and very hard to deal with, but speaking to that constituency, he was on their wavelength. He was on their wavelength better than I, for sure, and better than anybody else we had in the House. And above and beyond that, John was willing to go out there and say those tough, hard things that many cabinet officers simply were unwilling to do.
He's a delightful fellow to listen to.
Oh, yeah. Now, another section that's kind of part mine and part Parker's is John Guthrie's spokesman section. You know, John is a mechanic, is what he really is. And Parker uses him in calling the cabinet together and that type of thing that falls under the appointment secretary. Well, I also owned about half of them, and his job for me was the physical distribution of the talking papers and other speech lines that our office produced all throughout, even during the Watergate thing, and relaying that material physically to the cabinet and the other spokesmen. John's function was mechanical. It was not policy, it was not philosophical, but it was the getting into the hands of the right people the right material. Now, Dick Moore does not work for me, but he also, during this period, has kind of been a senior counselor to me whenever I have ever had any question about which way to go, what road to take, and so forth. I've usually bounced it off Dick Moore. But Dick is not a line official. He's just kind of a floater who's willing to give advice to anybody who asks for it, and I ask for it considerably.
Does that touch the principals then, Tim?
I think so.
Jim Holland, Harold Linebaugh, Al Snyder.
Well, okay, I've got a couple more. Wanda Phelan is the head of my correspondence section. Now, you do realize that when any member of the media, whether it be a reporter or the president of CBS or the publisher of a newspaper, writes a letter to either the president, myself, or Ron Ziegler, it automatically goes into our correspondence section. And Wanda Phelan heads that up, and she and two secretaries. And she's got about a form letter for almost anything anybody asks for or wants. And her job is to reply quickly to those people in the name of the president or myself or Ziegler. We also had another shared, what I call a shared resource, and that was Agnes Waldron and her research section, which both the press office and this office used equally, I think. And normally when Agnes was doing research for one of us, it was she would send a copy to the other because everybody needed it sooner or later anyway. So that was another shared resource we had. And then, of course, one of the things that Agnes did was to cull out the pro, con, and neutral editorials of the major newspapers throughout this country, and give me a report periodically on changes in editorial policy. the Chicago Tribune getting off the ship and coming out opposed to the president was probably the most well-known example of a change in editorial position. But we usually could keep pretty well good track of the pulse of the nation's newspapers simply by noting every time they had a switch in a position.
The Mort Allen News Summary, was that under your eye?
Never under us. No, it was always, it was either independent always or it was connected with Buchanan in a very unusual way. I think Pat initially started the thing himself and somehow kept control of it as it passed on to Mort Allen and so forth. But it was never officially connected with us, although I must say that Mort's office, because of the number of publications it went through, acted as kind of a research arm for us and others who wanted to know what such and such a newspaper said 3 months ago about this subject. Mort, frankly, in many cases, was faster at that sort of thing than Agnes Waldron was.
Well, it struck me that there was, it seemed on the surface at least, to be either a lot of overlap there or very much of a parallel type operation between what he was doing and some of this that you were doing.
Yeah, in a research sense it was. We started to depend on Mort a little more often after the election. Now, during the election, I had pretty much control of the Republican National Committee's research division. And at the time, it was pretty extensive operation and really produced an awful lot of material. But they kind of went out of business right after the election. So we turned more to Mort and more to Agnes after that. I guess there's one other thing you should know, and that is that the Republican National Committee's publications were under my direction and still were under my direction until President Ford took the oath of office, at which time the responsibility was shifted back to the Republican National Committee. When I first came here, Charlie Colson had the responsibility for programming the articles in First Monday and Monday Magazine. And after a time, I took over that function. And even after the election, we continued here to make suggestions on what articles should go in there, what the cover ought to look like, how many pictures of the president should be in it, and affect the format for that magazine. And we've done that ever since. I guess Colson kept it for about 4 months after I arrived here, and then I took it over, and I've had it ever since. The other thing that you should know is that I have been, and I guess that stopped too when President Ford took over, have been responsible for private polling. Although paid for by the Republican National Committee, they were commissioned by me with questions that were worked out between myself, Al Haig, and usually Pat Buchanan.
How many of those actually were done? Is this on a weekly basis or on a subject basis whenever the need arose?
Initially it was a subject basis, but then when Sendlinger and Company went to a subscription format, by that I simply mean that we used to pay for a poll. Give us a poll with the following questions and then we will give you a check for $5,000 or whatever the amount was. Sendlinger went on a subscription basis. And we became one of his subscribers after the election. Now that simply meant that he was polling continuously. And if you were a subscriber and you wanted four or five of your own questions inserted into today's poll and have it go on for 7 days, you could do that simply because you were a subscriber. So we would insert our questions into his polling apparatus whenever the president felt he needed to know something. For example, we had those questions inserted after the Mideast trip and after the Russia trip just recently. And we've had some questions inserted on the economy over the past few months. But frankly, in the last 9 months, the president's desire to know how the people were feeling about him prompted most of the questions that we inserted in the poll.
Did you write many articles that appeared in newspapers or magazines or other trade journals or anything while you've been here?
Yes, but always under other persons' names.
Not under your own?
No.
Your secretary for the major period of time, would it be fair to say, was Elizabeth O'Neill or Elizabeth Murfree?
Yeah, especially during the election campaign. Yes, I'd say that that would be true mainly. Now, in December, when we had the situation in San Clemente that I told you about, the splitting of duties and our own new expansion, Elizabeth became a staff assistant, and I have two secretaries out here. Susan Peterson and Gail Campbell became the secretaries, and Elizabeth started handling more substantive stuff.
How could we reach you in the years to come, Ken, if, as we go through the files, questions arise that we would like some additional information on? Do you have any sort of a permanent mailing address?
Well, my home, I suppose, in McLean, Virginia.
Some people just throw up their hands and say, God, I don't know where I'm going to be 5 years
from now. I don't either.
Would Harvard keep track of you?
Yes,
the Alumni Association.
The Nieman Foundation at Harvard would always keep track of me, I think.
Where are you originally from?
Monroe, Michigan. My parents still live there.
Well, that touches on the questions that we like to ask. God knows you went to great deal of detail on all of this, and I've enjoyed this immensely.
I have too. Let's just keep it a secret for another 15 years. No, one of the things that I must say to you, and I think it's a good way to sum this up, I have a feeling that it's not going to be before 10 years from now, that anybody becomes fascinated enough with the mechanics of the Nixon 72 election campaign to go into it in any depth, the kind of depth that you and I have talked about it, and you understand that I'm giving you, what, a slice of a 20th of that campaign? The Watergate thing has so overshadowed the campaign that it's going to take a long time before historians realize that this was probably, Watergate aside, the best run, most complete, most detailed political effort in the history of this country. And I think there's no better example than my giving you the sandwich theory. Guy in the day before, guy in the day after. And having, in effect, the opponent be skewered without ever realizing that he had been. And I think that shows you the detail that the planners of this campaign, and I am not one of the planners. I wish that I was one of the planners. One of the things that fascinated me so much about coming over here in February of 72 was that I was to help plan the president's 1972 campaign. Well, obviously, when I got here, I realized that the campaign had been planned a long, long time before that. Now, I was responsible for making some modifications in the campaign, but frankly, the basic structure of the 72 campaign was locked in concrete, probably as early as 18 months before I ever arrived here. And that in itself, I think, is a fascinating thing.
Well, I agree with you, and I think, I know Nesbitt's a political scientist, and this is just right up his alley. And from the time he came on board, he has expressed a great deal of interest in getting as much documentation on the campaign. Of course, this is, as you've indicated, this was even before the thing began to roll. And he made several trips over to Creep, and he talked with Rob Odle and a couple of others over there, and he's always been quite happy that we've been able to get those papers. Now again, unfortunately, Watergate has played such a role in it that a lot of people raise their eyebrows about the Creep papers as though, you know, there's something illegal or what have you about those papers. Not at all the case.
No, one of the things that's pretty clear to me now, and frankly, it wasn't clear during the campaign itself, and that is that I think that if a person could get inside of Haldeman's mind, you see, one of the, I happened to meet Jeb Magruder, I had a couple of dealings with him, probably within the first couple of months I was over here. And in both of those dealings, I came away with the impression that he was a ding-a-ling. Just totally incompetent. And the first thing that I did upon coming to this realization, say in March of 72, was to say to Haldeman, how can you have a jerk like that over at the campaign? I mean, at that time, you know, it was a campaign. We didn't know if we were